Welcome to SDI Encounters, a podcast from Spiritual Directors International. I'm Matt Whitney. Thank you so much for listening. I offer a heartfelt welcome to new listeners and a welcome back to existing subscribers. If you like this show, please do click on the subscribe button. Here we offer a wide range of perspectives, stories, and conversations centered around community, spiritual companionship, and spiritual care. You'll find additional information, including videos, webinars, and digital publications at our website, sdiworld.org. Dr. Diane Millis is an inspirational speaker, teacher, writer, and spiritual director. She's definitely one of the most deeply respected and most popular workshop presenters at SDI's annual conferences. And what a delight it was for me to talk with Diane about her involvement with SDI and about her unique and creative approach to spiritual direction via the art of storytelling. In her new book, Dr. Diane Millis shows us how to author a new story for our lives. In the book, she asks us, is your life what you thought it was going to be? Do you ever find yourself comparing the story of the life you wish you had lived with the life that you are actually living? Each of us has a story that we tell ourselves about ourselves. Becoming aware of our inner narrative is crucial because the story we tell ourselves, both consciously and unconsciously, has tremendous power over our thoughts, feelings, and actions. In many ways, this story defines our lives. So the book is titled Recreating a Life: Learning How to Tell Our Most Life-Giving Story. This book is also the first offering of SDI Press, a new publishing arm of Spiritual Directors International. Diane lives in Minneapolis and currently teaches at United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities. Diane and I recorded our chat via web conferencing software, and so the audio can sound a little bit metallic at times, just so you know.
Well, I like to ask for my own personal curiosity, but for people listening too, like, is there a particular spiritual practice that you have personally that is life-giving for you?
Yeah, for me, I love to start the day in quiet, in reflection. My tradition, I've been raised Roman Catholic, and so we have a set of prayers, and I open up my prayer book, and I read the psalm for the day, and I read the scriptures for the day. And so that roots me in the tradition, which is a part of me. And then I set that down and I sit with my coffee and I sit in quiet for, 15, 20 minutes. I usually like to do a minimum of 20 minutes of sitting. Mm-hmm. And some of the time when I'm working on a book, like I was this fall, I didn't spend the time in the quiet sitting. I spent the time in the deep listening to the writing process. So that, to me, is another form of contemplation and reflection. But that morning, that creating a habit in the morning of beginning, dipping into that quiet well, attunes my spirit to punctuate the rest of the day returning to that quiet. So, and I also do my best to just reduce noise around me, Matt. So, in the evening at 6 p.m., I love to turn on the PBS NewsHour, but often throughout the day, if I'm working in my office, I don't have, extra noise going on. I just bracket out external noises as much as possible. And really try to be selective about with electronic devices. I want to make sure that I'm making the choice to look at this screen. I'm making the choice to take this in rather than just being, bombarded with a fire hose with all this stuff coming at me. Yeah. So So punctuating my day with silence and cultivating attention is key. And where I live, I can't always get outside to walk in silence, but that's another thing, depending on the season, I try to build in, you know, as part of the quiet contemplative practice. I think the embodied part of this is so key.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I love the visual you gave of the dipping into the well of quiet, that cup of cold water that you know when you haven't had it in a day because of all the other noise that you just described.
Yeah.
That cup of quiet in the morning can sustain you throughout the whole day, even when things are noisy.
That's right.
But if you haven't had it, that noise can just overwhelm you, and it you forget. You forget. You become attuned to the noise and not
yes. Quiet. I know you're a parent. I no longer have a young child at home, but many years that was my reality. And so there are days you can't start in that quiet. You can't get up early enough. But then are there ways you can find a dip into that at some point in the day? So I don't want to be absolutist about this having to be the morning. But right now my lifestyle lends itself to that more. And I'm grateful for that. Yeah.
Let's talk about SDI for a minute.
Sure. Sure.
How did you find SDI? What drew you into SDI and what compels you to be a part of the community here?
Well, I trained in spiritual direction in the late 90s. And it was strongly recommended after we finished our training that not only do we commit to ongoing supervision and professional continuing education, professional development, but that we have a professional organization or guild to contribute to receive from. I registered for SDI. It was a couple of years before I attended a conference. And I was in my late 30s at the time. So at that time, I was one of the youngest people at the conference, if not the youngest. And I felt a little odd. I felt a little like on the outside looking in. And so the next year I gave a presentation but I still kind of felt on the outside looking in. And so I took a couple of years off because I wasn't sure if it was the best organization for me. And then I decided, you know what, the journal and the articles and the topics being addressed by SDI they're so integrated. They're bringing together the psycho, the spiritual, they've got the poetry, so there were just, the synthesis and the integration was of great interest to me as a scholar, actually. And I really wanted to see the journal thrive. And so I volunteered to serve on the editorial board and they said, sure. And I started writing more for the journal. I enjoyed reviewing the articles. So I found a fit where I could make more of a contribution. And then about a year or two after that, I got a call from our former executive director. And she said, Diane, I know you do a lot with college students and you do a lot of spiritual companioning with college students. And you really believe in how important their spiritual development is. She said, I'd like to start a new initiative called the New Contemplatives for spiritual companions and those interested in learning more about spiritual companioning in the first half of life. And I was just all on board. I was all in, whatever I could do to help with that, because I had felt like such an anomaly as a person in the first half of life when I first joined SDI. And I also have always rejected or resisted the notion, and I think we can blame it on Carl Jung, who said it isn't until the second half of life that we really begin to develop our spirituality. And I don't think that's at all true. That's not been true in my experience. That's not true of many of the young people that I've worked with. I think our spirituality may take on different forms in our second half of life, but I don't think there's any cookie cutter first half, second half. So I really resisted that. And I was very, very interested in how can we increase the array of participants and have more people in their 20s and 30s who are called into this way of being, which is what I refer to spiritual companioning as, a way of being. And so once I began, you know, kind of setting up the process for the first cohort of new contemplatives, I just felt very alive. And I since then, you know, it's been six some years now, I see a changing demographic among us. And I'm absolutely thrilled to see not only the expansion generationally, but the diversity of the participants. So now, rather than being on the periphery, I feel we've just created a very hospitable center. And so I love the image we're talking about of SDI as a public square. That is very appealing to me. And I love seeing people in every stage of life and what they can offer in terms of what does contemplation look like? How do they live into contemplation? How do they live into companioning? These are all questions that are wildly interesting to me.
Yeah, that's awesome. I didn't know that you played such a formative role in getting the new contemplative initiative off the ground. And that just is such a vital part of who we are, and it injects so much energy and vigor and diversity and breadth into the community. So yeah, thanks. Thanks for doing that.
It was my pleasure. You know how they say out of our wounds can often come our gifts? And I just, that to me had always been, I felt people didn't take me seriously because I didn't have gray hair and I wasn't yet over 40. And I think that's especially challenging as a woman as well. And so I want to create a space that we can call out the truth, the beauty, the goodness, the wisdom of our younger folks, because it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. And also the intergenerational mentoring. I mean, one of the greatest gifts for me in my increasing involvement in SDI is I've made some of my closest friends through our membership. And, you know, receiving the wisdom of people who have been on this journey for decades more than I have been. So it goes both ways. But we really, you know, our conference this year, the Seeking Connections Across Generations, I think we now will have in the room, just by our very membership, that greater intergenerational composition. And I'm thrilled about that.
So we just finished putting together your book, which is the very first offering of SDI Press, which is an honor and a delight. And I've been working with you on the cover and the layout, and so have been, you know, intimately getting to know the content and your vision for it. But maybe lay out a little bit, just what hopes do you have in sharing this work? How does it help? Who is it for? What is the work of the text? That's the question I want to ask.
Okay, sure. Well, you know, one of my guiding adages as a teacher has always been, what you most want to learn, teach. And I've just always been fascinated with narratives, I've always been fascinated with hearing other people's stories. From the time I was a little girl, I was a curious little girl. And people used to often say to me when I would ask question after question, "What are you, writing a book or something?" And so I've always had an inquiring mind, and I've had a lot of interest in what makes people tick. And so it's no surprise, as somebody who studied and taught communication studies and then family studies and then, you know, the area of spiritual formation, that stories are just a part of all of that. You know, they're woven into all of that. And so for me, I think I've grown to appreciate how transformative stories can be by accompanying others in exploring theirs and by exploring my own. So this book was just this very privileged time and occasion to reflect more deeply on my own story, in hopes that by doing so, it would offer an example and perhaps encouragement for others to do the same. But much of what I offered in this book, Matt, came out of years of teaching, and years of retreat work and years of accompanying people in spiritual direction. So in many ways, I don't feel like there was a lot new. It was an opportunity to synthesize and summarize and kind of house in all one place some of my favorite things. So I was very grateful for the invitation. I think that SDI is the optimum place to publish this, because I think this is what we do and why we do what we do. You know, is look at our lives. For me, when I think about how the sacred is at work in my story, I think of how I name God or how I name the ultimate is this co-creator, this co-author. And so the more time that I move into mining the meaning in my story, the more intimately I become attuned to that co-creator at work in my life. So we can talk a bit more about that if you are interested in doing
this. Yeah, I am. Yeah. It's you're right. Like that is the work of the text, and it's the work that we do at SDI as a learning community of spiritual companions. You know, what is a spiritual companion except just somebody who listens to other people's stories and being a listener for that thread that I believe runs through all of our lives.
Yeah.
And so when you talk about stories, and I'm thinking now just of, I think that's something that we're pretty comfortable with. Like we're pretty lovey-dovey here at SDI.
Yes, we are.
One another's stories.
Yes.
But you know, if I was like talking with my friends, you know, and I was like, "Oh, we listen to one another's stories." Mm-hmm. And I can imagine someone being like, well, what do you mean? Like, I know what a story is. I think of like, the grand stories of, you know, Star Wars or something, you know, just for example, right? And
sure.
Like, that's a story. Or like that novel I read, The Lord of the Rings, you know, that doesn't apply to me. Like, I'm not interesting, right? I'm just like an ordinary, everyday person. Like, I hustle to work and I have kids or whatever. And I don't get it. What do you mean? And so and I'm sure you've had people, you know, in your teaching before who have been like, "Well, I don't have an interesting story." How do you talk to them? How do you open people up? How do you awaken in them that divine story within them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I probably don't start in the way that many of us start socially, like hey, Matt, what's your story? Yeah. You know, where we want that kind of the just the facts, ma'am. You know, I was born here. I went to school here. I, you know, this is, I'm in these relationships. This is my family. This is my work. You know, that's a dimension of it, but that's really just the top layer if we're talking about mining the meaning. What I like to do, one of the questions you asked me to think about is what's one of the exercises in the book that might illustrate this working with stories in new ways? And one of the first things I invite people to do, regardless of their age, I was just offering a retreat on a college campus a couple of weeks ago. And I invited, it was a women's retreat, I invited the young women to write their story as a fairy tale. And for me, thinking about our story as a fairy tale, first of all, it gets us into a different genre. So I'm not talking about, I'm Diane, I was born in 1962, et cetera, et cetera. I'm now into this mythical realm of a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And now I am witnessing myself as a character in a story. So like the Lord of the Rings, our stories consist of characters, right? They consist of archetypal energies. They consist of heroes and villains and other archetypes and forces. And so by inviting them to narrate their story in a genre we're all familiar with, I think across cultures, people know of fairy tales. The fairy tales in their cultures may be different, but they're typically accustomed to that genre. And so I introduced to these young women an example of a fairy tale, and it wasn't a long one. You know, you can write a fairy tale in 10 minutes. And I give them 10 to 15 minutes, write your fairy tale. And then I invite them to turn to someone and take turns reading their fairy tale. And for the person who is reading the fairy tale, what did they discover about their story through telling it as a fairy tale? And I was delighted because at break, I had so many young women come up to me and want to read their fairy tales to me. So I knew that this was really, really valuable to them as a learning activity.
Yeah.
And then I asked them, what did you discover? So let me offer an example to illustrate. Mm-hmm. I had one young woman, and it wasn't a long fairy tale. Here again, this can be done in a page or less. And she read, and in her family, there was this recurrent illness throughout the generations. They've been fighting with, you know, this inherited illness. And she said, in writing her fairy tale, she noticed how creatively throughout the generations, she and her family members had responded to the challenge of this illness. She said she'd never seen that in her story before. She was very aware that they'd been coping with illness throughout their lives and subsequent generations. Mm-hmm. But to see that thread of creativity and what I might name or you might name resilience was a big aha. Now that gives her room to develop her story further. So at one level, she was telling parts of events she's always told. Illness has been a constant in my generation and previous generations. But now she's narrating a deeper meaning in the story, a meaning that she's attributed to it, yeah. Which is creativity is at work. There's something meaningful going on here. There's an invitation. Psychologists will say she's telling a redemptive story. This is awful to have to deal with this illness generation after generation, but somehow she's learning how to tell a redemptive story, that there's meaning, there's growth, there's hope, there's something that there's life. It's a life-giving story she's learning to tell. So here's a 20-year-old woman, never thought to tell her story as a fairy tale, spent about 15 minutes, and now has a new way of being in relationship to herself as a character in the story and others in the story. So that to me, I love the fairy tale because it gives us a new way of looking at the life we've lived. We could also then go into the future and talk about a fairy tale version of the life we hope to live. So when I'm working with narrative, it's always helping people to think about, okay, the story of who you are now, who you've been, who you aspire to be. Yeah. And sometimes we have more energy about, you know, when you're working with 20-year-olds, there's a lot of energy on who they aspire to be, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. When you're working with maybe 75, 80-year-olds, there's more energy about who they've been, the life they've lived,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Psychologists will say we're trying to tell a story that gives us a sense of integration rather than despair. So I think there are different narrative invitations throughout the life cycle. But I do think each of us has the Lord's, an epic story to tell.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
If we give one another, you know, some tools, some creative new ways of imagining and working with our story. And for me, approaching my story and myself as a character in my story breaks me out of my identification of myself as a narrator. So a lot of the exercises in the book, I'm trying to get people away from identifying with narrating the perfect story and entering into following yourself around as a character in your story, observing mm-hmm. yourself. Because I think then we're open to more interpretations, more potential meanings.
I want to talk about that, but you just brought up something interesting. Maybe the creative block, right? Or the author.
Yes.
The pressure to be a good author.
Yes. Yes.
And how you confront that. And so you were just describing how you, someone, like, don't think of yourself as the author, but think of yourself as an observer, like an outside observer in your own life.
So, both and.
Yeah.
First of all, what I know developmentally, and this is part of my conviction about sharing this with our colleagues at SDI, is in adolescence, early adulthood, we develop the capacity to self-author, to author a story about our lives. That's not just one we've been given by our family or by our culture or, you know, by our teachers, but we now have the capacity to self-author a narrative.
Hmm.
And then I would say it's incumbent upon us not only to do that initial authoring, but to continue to re-author throughout our lives, right?
Yeah.
So with that, one of the stances I believe we bring to our work as authors, whether it's the initial self-authoring I might do as a young adult, or as I move through life and I continue to make meaning of maybe the same experiences. You know, we've all had traumas, losses, challenges, right? That we're continuing to revisit and hopefully to, with the hope that greater revelation, greater meaning will come forth. I mean, from a spiritual perspective, that I firmly believe that we never exhaust the potential meaning that might be revealed in an experience in our life, especially the most challenging ones.
Yeah.
So for me to have that stance of not only I'm the narrator of this, but I'm a witness to this. You know, just like when we sit in meditation, we're a witness to the thoughts and feelings. You know, we hear that ongoing narration in our minds, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to invite people into some narrative exercises that help them develop the capacity to witness themselves as a character in their story.
Hmm.
And the other characters, to witness and interpret the other characters as well in their story. I think it gets our ego out of the way. And I think it gives a whole lot more room to be a little bit more playful with it. We can take our stories way, ourselves and our stories way too seriously, right?
Mm-hmm. And what I hear too is just how telling that story, what we find is that, like, we are telling a shared story, like as a common story,
absolutely,
a common humanity, joys, sorrows, tragedies, heartbreaks, excitement, you know, right? Like,
yes,
we all have those, and we can identify those within our own story, but then we also identify that thread by stepping outside of ourselves and seeing those. Do you think that makes us better listeners to other people's stories than in kind?
I think it has the potential to make us better listeners, and I think it has the potential in recognizing those shared dimensions in every story, that's why I can learn so much from your story, Matt. That your story can be illuminative for my own. I may have very different struggles than you, but as I listen to you relay your struggles, enter into them, trying to interpret how to make meaning, what's the invitation in this struggle, right? How might I grow through this struggle? How might I develop greater compassion? Whatever it may be. As I listen to you wrestle with that, that gives me insight into my story, into my struggles. So yes, I hope we increase our capacity to listen, but I think we have the potential to learn much about our own story through listening to others. And in the book, I talk about the principle, any story can serve, any person's story can serve as a portal into our own. Hmm. So the more I hear about your story, and the more in-depth you explore it, the more honest you are, willing to be vulnerable, the more it may give me insight into my own.
Yeah. Yeah. Storytelling, as you describe it, is a very creative act. Mm-hmm. I can think to, you know, even like a fourth grade creative writing time, you know, mm-hmm. like the sort of fun activity, you get to make things up, you get to write fantasies, you know, whatever. And I think like the crux of your book and your work is that the stories that we tell are not static.
That they're
malleable. They're changeable based on a lot of things, a lot of,
right.
But if the story's not right, then, you know, the outcome that I feel called to is not going to be necessarily achieved.
If the story is limiting, it's going to continue to limit us. And I think most of us, I think of the metaphor of a jukebox, which probably isn't as catchy in our digital age. But if you can remember a jukebox, right? And
yes,
you
push
your favorite, you know, and it would go on the turntable. And I think that's sometimes the way we are with our narratives, that if we don't take time to reflect on them, mm-hmm. if we're not, you know, meeting with a spiritual companion or able to share with a dear friend or gathering in a community where we continue to, you know, revisit and refresh and reauthor our stories, I think we just fall into putting those same old one or two records, our favorites, back on the turntable. And we may not even realize how limiting the narrative is, you know, so, and that we have a choice. I think for me, one of my greatest hopes for this book is that people see they have a choice about the story they can tell.
Yeah.
It's not the circumstances in our lives that dictate the outcomes of our life. It's the story we tell about them. Mm-hmm. You know, right now I've been fascinated. One of the streams of literature I like to follow is the literature on happiness. And recently I was introduced to a concept, and it's been out there for 20 years, Matt. It's called post-traumatic growth. Now, how often do you hear in the media about post-traumatic growth? Can you think of some time in the last, I don't know, have you... For me, that was a new term. Now, what do we hear about? We hear about, what's the narrative we tell? We hear about post-traumatic stress disorder,
Right? Yeah.
And so the suggestion is that trauma is going to relate, you know, result in stress, and it's going to lead to disorder, and there's going to be, and I'm not trying to valorize trauma at all. What I'm trying to say is there is a different way we can narrate the reality of trauma in our lives. Mm. And there may be initial stress and absolutely the need for healing and absolutely maybe some intensive therapeutic work. I'm not trying to suggest otherwise, but what I'm trying to suggest is we're often just narrating the stories of trauma in one way of a disorder rather than post-traumatic growth. How is it that we may grow and develop capacities in ourselves that we might not otherwise have ever developed? So that's a larger narrative frame we're using as a society. And the media is choosing to continue to focus on PTSD. But I don't hear news coverage talking about post-traumatic growth, although it's been in the psychological literature for a couple of decades now. Mm-hmm. So this points to the way we're choosing to frame. It's not the experience, it's the story we're telling about the experience.
Wow.
And if we realize we have a choice. So one of the other terms I introduce in the book, very early on in the book, because it was such a huge aha for me, is that we can tell a story in one of two ways, psychologists will tell us. We can tell a story in a redemptive way or a contaminative way. So let's go back to the example of the student I met a couple of weeks ago that, you know, she and her family have been dealing with illness, intergenerational illness. She chose to tell a redemptive story. She chose to tell about the growth that they're experiencing, the creativity, the resolve, the bond. I mean, she named... She's not saying, oh, this is easy, but she's finding redemptive features of the experience that's giving them meaning, that's giving them a sense of purpose, that's giving them a stronger identity as a family. And she even used her last name to say, we as the, let's say the last name was, we the Smiths now stand for this as a result. That's a redemptive story. She could have easily told a contaminative story to say, you know what, we have this illness, and now the next generation has this illness, and we'll never be who we're capable of being because we are continuing to have to cope with this illness. So we could just not live full lives. Mm-hmm. So the contaminative story is, you know, this happened and I'll never be the same. Me personally, or my family, or our society will never be the same. We'll never be as good. So that's another choice we have. You know, do we look at the redemptive features, or do we tell it in contaminative terms? And the more I introduce this distinction, this way of narrating stories, the more people say to me, "Oh my gosh, Diane, it's just so empowering to have a way of naming the distinction."
Yeah.
You know, people intuitively know these are two different ways of framing a story, their story, or interpreting another. But they didn't realize that they had these ways of naming. So, and I think most importantly, I mean, ultimately, I don't just sit around and tell my story just because I like to reflect, although I do. Ultimately, I want to tell my story so that I can tell the most life-giving story, because that shapes not only my identity, that shapes my action. Mm. And so one of the key findings that a psychologist, Dan McAdams at Northwestern University, has found is those who tell more stories, more redemptive stories, are more generative, contribute to the common good, have a greater concern for others. And so ultimately, I think for our societal well-being, I think for our care of one another, it's incumbent upon us to really explore and learn together how to tell more life-giving stories so that we can contribute more to the common good. So to me, there's a connection between this personal reflection that we as spiritual directors are so committed to, but then we see the connection to the social fabric and to the common good.
Can you talk about the importance, you touched on this, of community or companions?
To help
us discern that most life-giving story.
Yeah. So Matt, you and I have worked, you created this beautiful cover for the book, and I had...
It was fun.
It was so much fun to work together, yes. And I had suggested to you, I wanted to have something that reflected light, like a prism. Because one of the most apt metaphors when I think about sharing our stories with one another is we're offering our story, we're holding up our story, and we're looking at it from various angles. So here again, you know, back to the person who's experienced this illness in her family, she's going to look at these experiences from various angles. Mm-hmm. And you know, she may be accustomed to a certain way of thinking about illness, but others who are listening to her story, first of all, bring new eyes. They hear it in new ways. They bring a beginner's mind to the story, you know, a freshness to the story, new perspectives. Mm-hmm. They also see, if I were holding up a prism, they would see new light in it, refracted in new ways. And so my fundamental conviction that I say throughout the book is, in order to tell our most life-giving story, we need community. We need at least one other person. And I would argue we need, a community of concern, at least a handful of other people who continue to accompany us. And it may not be the same people throughout our lives, but to know that we have these committed companions who listen to our stories. I taught a course that I work with. I teach at a seminary, and I work with students preparing for ministry or students preparing for nonprofit leadership. And these folks are really compassionate, wonderful listeners. You know, they bring these skills to one another. But what so many of them seem to lack is that they maybe didn't have self-compassion for their own stories.
Yeah.
It was amazing to witness. I was able to travel with these students over the course of a semester, and I noticed the compassion, and they were so invested in one another's stories. They wanted the storyteller who was struggling with something to be able to see the very best in themselves. It was like they were holding up a mirror to show them their beauty, truth, and goodness, right?
Yeah.
And what I began to notice as we moved through the semester is that the storyteller was beginning to see more and more of that in him or herself because others had held up that mirror.
Yes.
So whether it's a prism, whether it's a mirror, others bring perspectives that you know, we're limited in what we can see in our own stories, in our own lives. And so one of the things, both in the book and in the workshops I offer, is helping those committed listeners who accompany them, giving them some tools for responding and accompanying and working with another's stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like we can have the best intentions, but we might tell like a negative story just out of fear of sounding narcissistic or too like, you know, self-centered or ego-driven. And that can really sabotage that process, I'm sure. And I hear that somehow. Having other people be like, what? No, like, that's really okay.
or we can step in and be tempted to try to interpret another story in a redemptive way for them. And I would just say that is absolutely not what we're there to do.
Mm-hmm.
We're just not there to do. We're there to witness and accompany them and give them the courage to do the kind of deep, you know, moving a bit deeper into the experience. And inviting them through the questions we ask and through our witnessing presence to reflect more deeply and to speak that. Maybe speak it for the first time in new ways, right? But it's, so it's the, I think of it as the 1-2, that both the encouragement, giving them the courage to move into those delicate places maybe we would rather not revisit, and then the compassion, the willingness to suffer with. And I have witnessed time and again how that engenders such immense self-compassion. And the more we have self-compassion, the more we begin to tell a more redemptive story, right? Because we aren't so, we're not so hard on ourselves. We're not so limited. We're not so critical. We began to interpret other qualities and characteristics of ourselves as a character in the life we're living.
Yes, self-compassion. We all need a little more self-compassion.
We really do. We really do. Even those of us at SDI, right?
Yeah.
We do. We do.
Absolutely.
We just wrapped up our annual conference, Seeking Connection, here in Bellevue, Washington, which is near where I live in Seattle. And my wife came by to visit me in the middle for a couple of hours. And it was her first exposure to the SDI community. And I wanted it to be impactful, you know, first impressions and all that. So I took her to Diane's workshop on storytelling. And she came out a couple hours later, totally delighted. She said, "Everyone is so lovely and warm-hearted. Diane had me write a fairy tale version of my life. I read it aloud to a partner and it was a lot of fun." So here's a freebie exercise from Diane's book that you can do. Write your story as a fairy tale, your life story. How do you portray yourself as a character? Are you a hero, a villain, a princess, a witch in the forest, or some other type of character? And who are the other characters? And what are the main events? Write this story, tell it as a fairy tale. It doesn't have to be that long, 1 to 2 pages at the most. And certainly don't feel any pressure to end this story, especially not with a happily ever after. And then read that story back to yourself or to a trusted spiritual companion. What do you discover in the reading? Do you learn anything new about yourself? How does your companion respond to your story? To gain more insight in developing the story that you need to tell, you can pick up a copy of the book, which is called Recreating a Life, Learning to Tell Your Most Life-Giving Story by Dr. Diane Millis, which is now available from SDI Press. It can be purchased online at our store, secure.sdiworld.org. That URL again is secure.sdiworld.org. This is Matt Whitney with Spiritual Directors International. Thanks again for listening. Your time and your presence here are deeply appreciated. If you liked this show and would like us to continue making them, please do subscribe now while it's fresh on your mind. Also, we would love to hear from you, so please feel free to send in your comments and suggestions to the email address podcast@sdiworld.org. To learn more about spiritual companionship and ways that you can plug in and join our community, visit us at our website at www.sdiworld.org. Thank you. Blessings and peace on your day, and may you share blessings and peace to others.